there have been growing calls to end what some describe as an era of mass incarceration in the United States, with over 2 million Americans imprisoned and a higher incarceration rate than any other developed country. Some critics, including our next guest, say we need to make a change.
Stan Stojkovic is with us now. He's professor of criminal justice and dean of the Helen Bader School of Social Welfare at UW-Milwaukee. Stan, welcome to the show.
Thank you for having me.
Well, this is prompted by a letter we saw of yours to the New York Times. You're responding to an editorial on mass incarceration, and you write, "I believe that the concept of redemption must play a much larger role." Have we lost sight of the idea of redemption in our crime and punishment system?
I think in the last 30 years in particular, redemption as a concept, as a correctional concept, is not necessarily a new thing. The idea of prison was to allow people to atone for their sins early on and then ultimately come back into society. But somewhere at the latter part of the 20th century and into the 21st century, we lost complete sight of that. And so the mass incarceration movement was really designed to forget about redemption and to simply be retributive or punishment-oriented. And that has had enormously negative consequences on our society.
Is it just punishment incorporated or oriented or safety? Having people locked up means they're not out committing crimes.
Well, the fact of the matter is that the contribution of prison to ultimately long-term safety is there, but it's not the only thing. The fact is that at some point in time, you're going to have to make decisions, since 99% of all people in prison are going to eventually walk out. The question becomes, how do you want them to walk out, and walk out to what? What's really available to them? We are now seeing across this country, Wisconsin included, massive reentry efforts, because we've got people who are sentenced under laws back in the 1980s, 1990s. They're now coming out of prison. Many of them have nothing. They don't have any skills. But there are people who are in prison, and regardless of this sort of, and in spite of this terrible conditions that they're under, they still are able to improve themselves and have shown redemption. And so redemption is a concept that requires behavioral change that can be documented. And I think that it's about time that we really focus our energies on something like that, as opposed to simply being retributive.
And you were just describing the impacts this has on people locked up. You also write that our system of mass incarceration is crushing our society spiritually. How so?
Well, what we're doing is we're looking at people only in one light. Now, I know that's difficult for people to look in a different light, particularly someone who's a hardened criminal. But the fact of the matter is, redemption and forgiveness is the essence of what many people in this country believe to be their spiritual faith, whether it's an organized religion or it's some spirituality. The idea of redemption and forgiveness is actually very positive. It's a human condition that says, I recognize the wrong you did to me, but I also recognize that you have an opportunity to change that. Now, there are many prisoners who don't avail themselves of those opportunities, and corrections officials can tell you about them ad nauseum. But the fact of the matter is, we have large numbers of people who are sitting in our prisons who have taken every program, every initiative, have educated themselves, and now are saying to them, I'm ready to come back. I'm ready for a break. Can you give me one? We have historically said, at least in recent history, the last 30 years, no. We don't even want to consider that. And I think that that's very short-sighted, let alone economically and socially devastating on our state budgets.
Let's follow that economic point up. What is the impact of the rising levels of incarceration over the last few decades?
Well, you can do a comparative, and I know that a lot of people in Wisconsin hate this comparative analysis, but the fact of the matter is, Minnesota does it right. And Minnesota started doing it right in the early 1970s, passing a Community Corrections Act, which really gave incentives to people to keep people in their counties and to work with them. It is estimated by the Wisconsin Taxpayer Alliance that since the early 1970s up to about 2010, Minnesota saved about $3 billion. Now think about that. Think of that enormity. Minnesota and Wisconsin are very alike, demographically, socially, politically in some cases, but they're very similar. But we chose to incarcerate large numbers of people. What could a city of Milwaukee, for example, where 50% of all prisoners in the state come from, what could they have done with $3 billion? Or even a portion of that money on road repair, education, health care? This is money and opportunities lost, huge opportunity costs. And the assumption that many people hold of the prisoners are really, they can't really provide anything, is blatantly false. There's enough evidence out there to say if we structure correct programming, use good assessment procedures, we can do things with people. And I think at the end of the day, forgiveness is economically viable and makes sense. and individuals, if you start to think this argument through, it's much more powerful kind of argument that I think has broad support, but we need to make people aware. And that's really my intention in the New York Times article.
And you mentioned the large portion of people in prisons coming from Milwaukee and probably concentrated, I imagine, in specific communities. What does mass incarceration do to those communities where a lot of people come into prison and then eventually come back out unready to do so?
It devastates these communities on all sorts of levels. It devastates them economically. It's taking away potential breadwinners, individuals who can pay taxes, as opposed to being a tax burden. Now, the assumption is that there is meaningful employment. That may be a questionable assumption, particularly in the city of Milwaukee now. But when it takes people out, it also affects social relationships. So, for example, African-American men who are disproportionately overrepresented in Wisconsin prisons, 12 to 13% nationally, and in Wisconsin a little less, but 50% of all admissions into our prisons. And from specific zip codes, it destroys those communities. Women who want to marry men of their own color, of their own race and ethnicity, have a much more narrow, smaller pool to choose from because many of these men are winding up in prison. And in Milwaukee's case, it's horrific, the impact. So there are all sorts of levels, but at the core, it spiritually reduces us. It takes us to a point where we ultimately are looking at another human being in a way that's defined as all negative, and that just doesn't make any sense moving forward. And I don't think right now, most states, Wisconsin included, have understood this. We can't afford this prolonged mass incarceration. The numbers are just too high.
The numbers are high. Is the public aware of this? Do people know this, or did it kind of happen gradually and out of sight, out of mind, to where it doesn't feel different if you're not directly connected to the prison system?
Well, that's a good point. I mean, I have been speaking about this for 30 years. And it's not just me. There's a lot of people out there. There are church people. There are family members. There are politicians. There are all sorts of groups who are out there have been talking about this for many, many years, that this is a train wreck. Years ago, when I asked specific people in the legislature, when they signed Truth in Sentencing into effect on January 1, 2000, I asked them, have you done an impact statement on this? And their response was incredulous. Was, what do you mean? We don't need that. We know it works. What works? What you only thing you know is you're going to fill up the prisons. And this is not something that's going to have a long-term beneficial effect. It may have a short-term political benefit to certain politicians, but it does not have the long-term support of citizens, because citizens do expect people to be held accountable, but they also expect corrections and the rest of society to do something with those people so that when they get out, they don't go back. That's the side of the equation that oftentimes politicians forget. But citizens are very clear in our opinion polls and our opinion research about correctional efforts. So there's a lot of issues associated with this, and it's obviously complicated, but I think we really need to start thinking differently.
Briefly, in Wisconsin, there was an early release program for geared at nonviolent offenders, getting them out of the prison system earlier, viewed as a cost saver, a change of administration, and that ended. Did you see that as a good first step? Were you disappointed when it changed?
I was disappointed because that was a good first step, and there was no empirical evidence. In fact, my review of the people who were left out, who actually got out sooner, and many of them got out a week or 2 weeks sooner than they would have anyway. This would have had no particular impact in terms of crime and recidivism. Many of them were being successful. Now, granted, the program was early. It didn't last long. But when the Walker administration came in, they basically gutted it, and they ended it. And that was a huge mistake. It was a step in the wrong direction, particularly if you're trying to send a message to these people, we're going to hold you accountable through the prison sentence that we're going to impose upon you, but we also have an expectation that you do something with yourself, and we will provide those resources. We haven't done that either, by the way. We've done a very bad, poor job, I should say, in doing that. So, again, complicated, but I think we need to really rethink things.
People who supported that change, ending that early release program, and probably people who work in the prison systems, I think, might say, yeah, sounds nice, Stan, this is wishful thinking. These are hardened guys. They're criminals. It's very hard to consider releasing them and think about the public safety impact they're going to have.
Well, then they would be misguided. Because the fact of the matter is some of them are hardened. They make up 5 to 10% of the prison population. Some of them we have to control. Some need to be in prison for a long time. I will not deny that ever. I'm a former prison worker, so I understand that. But the fact of the matter is most of our people are in medium security. They're classified as medium security. They don't require these kind of long, protracted sentences, particularly around the drug offenses. We can do something better, smarter, and more efficient, and ultimately have a long-term benefit, not only to them and their families and society, but also in the long run to future generations. We are saddling this state with enormous debt around correctional efforts that clearly do not show any kind of improvement in what we're doing right now, which is simply locking people up and throwing away the key. So I always say to those people, they're misdirected. If you look at the evidence doesn't support the assertions they put forward.
We're talking to Stan Stojkovic, criminal justice professor at UW-Milwaukee. He says we're locking too many people up for too long, and we need to embrace concepts of redemption and forgiveness and move away from an era of mass incarceration.
And you can join the conversation at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. Do you think we are locking too many people up in the United States? And do you agree with our guests that we should have more of a focus on redemption, rehabilitation, and forgiveness? Or do you think that people in prison need to do their time to keep the rest of us safe? Call with your thoughts at 800-642-1234 or post on the Central Time Facebook page. We continue our conversation now about prisons and redemption. Our guest is UW-Milwaukee criminal justice professor Stan Stojkovic. He says we lock too many people up for too long, and it's hurting the inmates, the communities they come from, and our nation as a whole.
And you can join the conversation at 800-642-1234 with your thoughts on mass incarceration in the United States. Do we lock too many people up for too long? Or are we following the right path despite the expense? 800-642-1234 or email talk@wpr.org. We'll go right to our callers. We've got Michael on the line in Milwaukee. Michael, hi.
Hi, good afternoon. Thanks for taking my call. I just wanted to speak from the viewpoint of the inmate. I was an inmate in Wisconsin prison system for over 3 years as a multiple drunk driving offender. And I went in there with someone who had a substance abuse or an alcohol problem, and I got absolutely no rehabilitation. And during that time, I lost my house. I lost relationships that I had cultivated over years. I lost the relationship with my 9-year-old daughter. I went into debt, 3 years in debt of not being able to pay bills. The state paid $32,000 a year to incarcerate me, and I got nothing out of it. And I can tell you from being in there with other drunk drivers at Prairie du Chien Correctional that they didn't get anything out of it. It embittered a lot of people. You come out so broken, so messed up. You lost everything you ever had before, and so many people just they end up so much worse off. My attorney asked if we could do Huber. I could have continued to pay my child support. Now I'm 3+ years behind in child support. That didn't help my daughter or her mother. It hurt them tremendously. I could have continued to pay child support, continued to pay taxes. I could have kept my house. I lost so much.
Michael, thank you so much for calling and sharing your story, and good luck to you and coming back from that. Stan, he tells a lot of that story. First, no rehab he saw in a correctional facility for drunk driving offenses.
Well, you know, rehabilitation and the devotion of resources in an institutional setting is somewhere between 10% to 15% of the correctional dollar. We don't put the money where we say we want to. And some states, like California, for example, Texas, if you can imagine, New York, Pennsylvania, they have really redirected a lot of funding because there is good evidence that good programming, good assessment can have an impact on changing people's lives. We have the technical skill in many cases. Now, I'm not here to offer a panacea solution. I don't have one. But we can do it a heck of a lot better and save a heck of a lot of misery. And by the way, the distinction between my approach and, let's say, a public safety approach is false. My approach will make you more safe, will ultimately make society more safe. We'll have fewer people than the previous caller experiencing the kinds of conditions. He's one of thousands who've come out of Wisconsin prisons in the last 15 to 20 years, really with nothing. and then we expect these people to succeed. It's no wonder that a vast majority of them fail.
And less than nothing, anyway. Not only no money in debt, but without the social connections that might help someone get going again.
Well, also, at a more fundamental existential level, they're spiritually dead. They are completely, their human spirit, which is the worst cost in the long run. If you want to destroy a human spirit, you consider current incarceration and its impact, not only on that person, as the caller said, the family, society on the whole. What is the purpose of that? I say in my editorial, at some point we got to start talking about then incarceration becoming simply cruelty.
We'll go back
is
to our...
that really what we're all about? I don't think so.
We'll go back to our callers now. We've got Jervis on the line in Milwaukee. Jervis, hi.
Hi, how are you?
Good. What did you want to bring up?
I didn't hear the other caller, but I guess I had the opportunity with working with Restorative Justice with Professor Gene Getzke out of Marquette University. I had an opportunity to actually sit and talk with the individual who murdered my father several years ago, and a couple of other times I'm going in, and I don't think people really appreciate the fact that these people who get in prison are really caught up in a moment, and they're forced to pay for the rest of their lives for an act that they committed. And they might have done a few other things, but the bottom line is a lot of them don't even realize the impact of their actions on individuals that they perpetrated these things against. And when the person who was who you're speaking to, the professor from UWM, talked about our religion of forgiveness, you know, my first thing that I tell people when I go there is that, you know, after reading a book by Dr. Martin Luther King, Strength to Love, is he has a sermon on that says, Father, forgive them, for they know not what they do, as Jesus hung on the cross. And I don't think people really understand that a lot of these individuals don't even realize what they've done. And they, you know, until they're confronted with an individual like me or a few others, then there's a softness that you see in these people that comes across.
Jervis,
and it's very powerful.
You met your father's murderer, you said. Were you able to forgive him?
Yes. I mean, I had worked through this process for several years, but then when the opportunity to come came, I actually sat across the table from him, and we talked for about 2 or 3 hours, and I had forgiven him before then. And at the same time I forgave him, I have to understand that now he has to go forward with that, knowing that he has that, and understand that from my standpoint and from my family standpoint, what he did was wrong, but now go forth with your life and do something with it, you know, and try not to do any more harm to anybody else. And I mean, I know that might sound very, utopic or whatever the case that we're looking for. But I honestly believe that that's what we're supposed to place hope in other people.
Jervis, thank you so much for sharing your story. Very powerful, Stan. We have to forgive, he says, and then the offender has to take that forgiveness and do something with it.
Yeah, my idea of redemption is I just don't forgive you for forgiveness sake. I forgive you because you've changed behaviorally. You've shown me that you really have atoned. You've taken on the responsibility of dealing with your children, dealing with your drug addiction, getting some education. That, to me, reflects redemption. It's a two-way street. Where restoration stops, redemption begins. Restoration is to try to make the process back into equilibrium. I want to go beyond that. I want to say I want people to be forgiven and ultimately prove that they deserve forgiveness, because not everybody does. So there's responsibility on both ends here. And it's really moving forward. And if we don't have that kind of philosophy, I think that we are in a bad place given the numbers that we have. And just the projecting those numbers and their costs are just horrific, both in human costs as well as financial costs.
Thanks so much for that call. We'll go to Nathan now on the line in Milwaukee. Nathan, hi.
Hello. How you doing?
Good. What did you want to bring up, Nathan?
My question is, it seems very nice and well, but what about the victims? You know, the victims go through a lot, and it seems sometimes the punishment doesn't equal the crime.
The punishment is insufficient, you're saying, to the enormity of the crime?
Absolutely.
Well, I can tell you this. That's not borne out by the evidence. If anything, the evidence suggests the exact opposite. The punishment is over. It's disproportionate in many cases. You must remember, too, we know a lot about victims, and I would never minimize victims in this process. The victims are very important, but at the end of the day, what you don't hear is victims saying, I want to move on with this, and I got to get on with my life. I've been devastated in some cases. Most crimes are not murders. They're not sexual assaults. There are a lot of those, don't get me wrong, but most crimes are not that serious. And the fact of the matter is, the question is, when do you use imprisonment and when do you not? Forgiveness and redemption is really about the idea of caring about everyone. Not only myself as a victim and a family member of a victim, but I'm also caring in a larger context. I'm caring about what's the best interest going forward for everyone involved. And I know that takes a lot of patience, but I'll tell you, victim research indicates most victims are interested in that. They want something. That's why, again, politicians tend to say, we simply want to lock people up. That's half the equation. Half the equation is accountability through locking people up. The other half is doing something with them. Most people who are reasonable understand that. And I'm telling you now, we don't have the luxury to think any different anymore. We just don't have the funds, and we don't have the wherewithal. And the impact on these communities, particularly large communities in like Milwaukee, are devastating.
Do you see the conversation changing, especially on the drug war? Are politicians maybe starting to be less ready to be tough on crime?
Well, I think what you're seeing is people trying to be more smart on crime. I mean, take, for example, Newt Gingrich. Newt Gingrich, very conservative, the man who led the Congress in the 1990s, right? He is leading a group of people who are trying to look at imprisonment as listen, we got to make better choices, and he's right. I may not agree politically with him on all sorts of issues, but on this issue, I'm in total unanimity and agreement with him. We've got to think smarter about how do we utilize our prison system. How do we utilize corrections? Also, we have to think about, again, spiritually, what does this say about us? All right, if we lead the world in mass incarceration. And, you know, the devil's in the details. Earlier you said 2 million people in prison. Well, it's 2.3 million, but about 1.7 are in prison, and 600,000 are in jails, and they're not the same institutions. Most of us have to become more educated about what these systems really are first, and then we can be knowledgeable about moving forward. But I think across the political spectrum now, whether they're being forced by a court, like in California's case, Supreme Court stepped in on their overcrowding and said, you've got to release X number of prisoners.
We'll have to leave it there. That's Stan Stojkovic, professor of criminal justice.